whatever pain, toxic elements, and dis-ease it is willing to or capable of surrendering. As you do this, you continue to pay attention from moment to moment, breath by breath, noticing that even in the most problematic regions of your body, the sensations you are attending to from moment to moment change in quality. You may notice that the intensity of the sensations can change as well. If it subsides a little, you can try going back to your toes and scanning the whole body. When practicing the body scan, the key point is to maintain awareness in every moment, a detached witnessing of your breath and your body, region by region, as you scan from your feet to the top of your head. The quality of your attention and your willingness to just feel what is here and be with it, no matter what it is much more important than imagining the tension leaving your body or the in-breath revitalizing your body. If you just work at getting rid of tension, you may or may not succeed, but you are not practicing mindfulness. But if you are practicing being present in each moment and at the same time you are allowing your breathing and your attention to purify the body within this context of awareness and with a willingness to accept whatever happens, then you are truly practicing mindfulness and tapping its power to heal. Healing energy can be directed toward others and toward your relationships, as well as toward your own body. This is a very effective way of healing yourself, because the process of generating strong feelings of empathy, compassion, and love toward others has its own purifying effect on your own mind and body and heart. When such strong positive feelings are invoked in a mind that has become relatively calm and stable through intensive meditation practice, these feelings can then be effectively directed toward others. For instance, in the practice of loving-kindness meditation, we begin by stabilizing the mind and calming it with mindfulness of breathing. Then we consciously invoke feelings of love and kindness toward ourselves, perhaps by saying inwardly to ourselves, "May I be free from anger, may I be free from hatred, may I be filled with compassion, may I feel kindness toward myself." Then we can go on to invoke someone else, perhaps a particular person we care about. We can visualize that person in our mind's eye or hold the feeling of the person in our own heart as we wish that person well. May he or she be happy. May he or she be free from pain and suffering. May he or she experience love and joy. We may then include others we know and love, parents, children, friends. Then we identify a person we may have a particularly difficult time with, perhaps someone we do not like to feel sympathy for. We intentionally cultivate feelings of kindness, generosity, and compassion toward this person, letting go of our feelings of resentment and dislike for that person, and reminding ourselves instead to see that person as a whole being, as deserving of love and kindness, as having feelings, as someone who feels pain and anxiety, someone who is suffering. If that person has caused us harm, we can, if we choose to, and only if we choose to, purposefully forgive him or her in our heart, letting go of our own anger and resentment and hurt, letting go of our feelings of righteousness, of our justifications for our lack of empathy. We can also ask that person to forgive us if we have caused him or her hurt, knowingly or unknowingly. This can be done with people whether they are alive or have already died, and there can be a strong release of long-carried negative emotions as you ask for forgiveness and forgive them. It is a profound process of coming to terms in your own heart and mind with the way things are in this moment, a deep letting go of past feelings and hurt. We can continue to direct loving-kindness toward others, perhaps toward those who we feel may be in need of positive energy, who are not as fortunate as we are. Then we can expand our scope still further, radiating our feelings of loving kindness to all people who are suffering, oppressed, in need of kindness and caring. The meditation can be carried even further, expanding the field of loving kindness out from our own heart in all directions, until it includes all life on the planet, not just people, and the living planet itself, if we like. Finally, we return to our own body. We come back to the breathing and end cradling our feelings of warmth and generosity and love for all beings in our own hearts. I always thought this kind of practice was a little strange and contrived until I experienced the power it had. When practiced regularly, loving-kindness meditation has a softening effect on the heart. It can help you to be kinder to yourself and to others in your own mind, to see all beings as deserving of kindness and compassion, so that even if disputes do arise, your mind can see clearly and your heart does not close down and become lost in self-serving yet ultimately self-destructive negative feeling states. In summary, healing is a transformation of you rather than a cure. It involves recognizing your intrinsic wholeness and simultaneously your connectedness to everything else. Above all, it involves coming to feel at peace within yourself. As we have seen and will see even more, this can lead to dramatic improvements in symptoms and a renewed ability to move toward greater levels of health and well-being. This inner response would be an awful lot to ask of ourselves in a stressful situation if we had the expectation that awareness and centeredness could just come out of nowhere whenever we needed them, or that we should be able to just will our mind and body to be calm when they are not. But in fact, we've been training mind and body to respond in this way right along, developing and deepening these very qualities in the formal meditation practice. Practically speaking, only through regular training to develop mindfulness could we possibly hope that our calmness and awareness would be strong enough and reliable enough to assist us in responding in a balanced and imaginative way when we are stressed. The capacity to respond mindfully develops each time we experience discomfort or pain or strong feelings during meditation, and we just observe them and work at letting them be there as they are, without reacting. As we have seen, the practice itself grounds us in alternative ways of seeing and responding to reactive states within ourselves, moment by moment. It introduces us to an entirely different kind of control. We come to see from our own experience that effective control can come out of inner calmness, acceptance, and openness, that we don't have to struggle with our thoughts and feelings or force things to be as we want them to be. One thing is certain. We know where the fight-or-flight reaction will lead if it is left to play itself out automatically. We have been on that route most of our lives. The challenge now is for us to realize that at any moment, we are in a position to actually decide to do things differently. In some situations, your feeling threatened may have more to do with your state of mind than with the triggering event itself. When you bring awareness to stressful moments, you might see more clearly how your own unbalanced view could be contributing to an inappropriate overreaction on your part, one that is out of proportion to what the actual circumstances warrant. Then you might remind yourself to try letting go of your own self-limited view right in that moment, just to see what would happen. You might try trusting that things will become more harmonious if you make the effort to meet the situation with calmness and clarity. Why not test this possibility for yourself once or twice? What would you have to lose? When you experiment in this way, you may be surprised at how many things that used to push your buttons no longer get you aroused. They may no longer even seem stressful to you, not because you have given up and have become helpless and defeated or resigned, but because you have become more relaxed and trusting of yourself. Responding in this way under pressure is an empowering experience. You are maintaining your own balance of mind and of body, what is sometimes called maintaining your center. When you know what you are feeling and have practiced reminding yourself that your feelings are just feelings and that they are okay to have and to feel, then you can begin to explore ways of being true to your feelings without letting them create more problems for you. When being assertive, it is very helpful to remember to say how you are feeling or seeing the situation by making I statements rather than you statements. If you are uncomfortable with your feelings, you might wind up blaming how you are feeling on the other person without even knowing it. Then you may find yourself saying things like, "You make me so angry," or "You are always making demands on me." Can you see that this is saying that the other person is in control of your feelings? You are literally handing power over your feelings to another person and not taking responsibility for your end of the system, which includes you both. The alternative is to say something like, "I feel so angry when you say this or do that." This is more accurate. It says how you feel in response to something. This leaves the other person room to hear what you're saying about how you see and feel without feeling blamed or attacked and without being told that he has more power than he actually has. Maybe the other person won't understand, but at least you have made an attempt to communicate without doing battle. This is where the dance begins. What you do or say next will depend on the particular circumstances. But if you are maintaining mindfulness of the entire situation and of your own thoughts and feelings, you will be much more likely to steer your way through to some kind of understanding or accommodation or agreement to disagree without losing or surrendering your own dignity and integrity, either through being passive or being aggressive. The most important part of effective communication is to be mindful of your own thoughts, feelings, and speech, as well as of the situation. It is also crucial to remember that you and your so-called position are part of a social system. If you expand the field of your awareness to include the whole system, this will allow you to see and honor the other person's point of view as well. Then you will be able to listen and really hear, to see and comprehend, to speak and know what you are saying, and to act effectively and assertively with dignity. Most of the time, cultivating this approach, which we might call the way of awareness, will resolve potential conflicts and create greater harmony and mutual respect. In the process, you are much more likely to get what you want and what you need from your encounters with other people, and so are they. 7. Letting go. They say that in India, there is a particularly clever way of catching monkeys. As the story goes, hunters will cut a hole in a coconut that is just big enough for a monkey to put its hand through. Then they will drill two smaller holes in the other end, pass a wire through, and secure the coconut to the base of a tree. Then they put a banana inside the coconut and hide. The monkey comes down, puts his hand in, and takes hold of the banana. The hole is crafted so that the open hand can go in, but the fist cannot get out. All the monkey has to do to be free is to let go of the banana, but it seems most monkeys don't let go. Often our minds get us caught up in very much the same way in spite of all our intelligence. For this reason, cultivating the attitude of letting go or non-attachment is fundamental to the practice of mindfulness. When we start paying attention to our inner experience, we rapidly discover that there are certain thoughts and feelings and situations that the mind seems to want to hold on to. If they are pleasant, we try to prolong these thoughts or feelings or situations, stretch them out, and conjure them up again and again. Similarly, there are many thoughts and feelings and experiences that we try to get rid of or to prevent and protect ourselves from having because they are unpleasant and painful and frightening in one way or another. In the meditation practice, we intentionally put aside the tendency to elevate some aspects of our experience and to reject others. Instead, we just let our experience be what it is and practice observing it from moment to moment. Letting go is a way of letting things be, of accepting things as they are. Letting go is not such a foreign experience. We do it every night when we go to sleep. We lie down on a padded surface with the lights out in a quiet place, and we let go of our mind and body. If you can't let go, you can't go to sleep. Most of us have experienced times when the mind would just not shut down when we got into bed. This is one of the first signs of elevated stress. At these times, we may be unable to free ourselves from certain thoughts because our involvement in them is just too powerful. If we try to force ourselves to sleep, it just makes things worse. So if you can go to sleep, you are already an expert in letting go. Now you just need to practice applying this skill in waking situations as well. Purposefully cultivating the attitudes of non-judging, patience, trust, beginner's mind, non-striving, acceptance, and letting go will greatly support and deepen your practice of the meditation techniques you will be encountering. In addition to these attitudes, you will also need to bring a particular kind of energy or motivation to your practice. Mindfulness doesn't just come about by itself because you've decided that it is a good idea to be more aware of things. A strong commitment to working on yourself and enough discipline to persevere in the process are essential to developing a strong meditation practice and a high degree of mindfulness. The spirit of engaged commitment we ask of our patients during their 8 weeks in the stress reduction clinic is similar to that required in athletic training. The athlete who is training for a particular event trains regularly, every day, rain or shine, whether she feels good or not, whether the goal seems worth it or not on any particular day. We encourage our patients to develop the same attitude. We tell them from the very start, you don't have to like it, you just have to do it. When the 8 weeks are over, then you can tell us whether it was of any use or not. For now, just keep practicing. Those of us who teach in the stress reduction clinic see meditation practice as an integral part of our own lives and of our own growth as people. So we are not asking our patients to do something that we don't do on a regular basis ourselves. Ultimately, however, we are asking even more than daily practice of our patients and of ourselves, for it is only by making the meditation a way of being that its power can be put to practical use. To tap this power in your own life, we recommend that you set aside a 45-minute block of time every day, or at least 6 days a week, for at least 8 consecutive weeks to practice. Just making this amount of time every day for yourself will be a very positive lifestyle change. The best way to get results from the meditation is not to try to get anything from it, but just to do it for its own sake. This paradoxical situation invites our patients to explore non-striving and self-acceptance as ways of being. It gives them permission to start from scratch, to tap a new way of seeing and feeling without holding up standards of success and failure based on a habitual and limited way of seeing their problems and their expectations about what they should be feeling. We practice the meditation in this way because the effort to try to get somewhere is so often the wrong kind of effort for catalyzing change or growth or healing, coming as it usually does from a rejection of present moment reality without having a full awareness and understanding of that reality. A desire for things to be other than the way they actually are is simply wishful thinking. It is not a very effective way of bringing about real change. At the first signs of what you think is, quote, failure, when you see that you are not, quote, getting anywhere, or have not gotten where you thought you should be, you are likely to get discouraged or feel overwhelmed, lose hope, blame external forces, and give up. Therefore, no real change ever happens. The meditative view is that it is only through the acceptance of the actuality of the present, no matter how painful or frightening or undesirable it may be, that change and growth and healing can come about. As we shall see when I talk about the paradigm, new possibilities can be thought of as already contained within present moment reality. They need only be nurtured in order to unfold and be discovered. If this is true, then you don't need to try to get anywhere when you practice the body scan or any of the other techniques. You only need to really be where you already are and realize it, which means to make it real. In fact, in this way of looking at things, there is no place else to go, so efforts to get anywhere else are ill-conceived. They are bound to lead to frustration and failure. On the other hand, you cannot fail to be where you already are, so you cannot, quote, fail in your meditation practice if you are willing to be with things as they are. In its truest expression, meditation goes beyond notions of success and failure, and this is why it is such a powerful vehicle for growth and change and healing. This does not mean that you cannot progress in your meditation practice, nor does it mean that it is impossible to make mistakes that will reduce its value to you. A particular kind of effort is necessary in the practice of meditation, but it is not an effort of striving to achieve some special state, whether it be relaxation, freedom from pain, healing, or insight. These come naturally with practice because they are already inherent in the present moment and in every moment. Therefore, any moment is as good as any other for experiencing their presence within yourself. If you see things in this light, it makes perfect sense to take each moment as it comes and accept it as it is, seeing it clearly in its fullness and letting it go. If you are unsure of whether you are practicing correctly or not, here is a good litmus test. When you notice thoughts in the mind about getting somewhere, about wanting something, or about having gotten somewhere, about success or failure, are you able to honor each one as you observe it as an aspect of present moment reality? Can you see it clearly as an impulse, a thought, a desire, a judgment, and let it be here and let it go without being drawn into it, without investing it with a power it doesn't have, without losing yourself in the process? This is the way to cultivate mindfulness. So we scan the body over and over, day by day, ultimately not to purify it, not to get rid of anything, not even to relax. These may be the motives that bring us to practice in the first place, and that keep us at it day after day, and we may in fact feel more relaxed and better from doing it. But in order to practice correctly in each moment, we have to let go of even these motives. Then practicing the body scan is just a way of being with your body and with yourself, a way of being whole right now. This is an exciting time in the history of medicine and the medical sciences. More is known about the details of the structure and functioning of living organisms on every level than ever before. Biological research is being carried out at a feverish pace, and we now know something about the genetic and molecular basis of a number of diseases. We also have an elaborate and continually growing array of drugs for controlling many infectious diseases and for regulating many of the physiological responses of the body when they get out of control. However, while more is known about disease than ever before, and while we have improved ways of diagnosing and treating many diseases, far more still remains unknown. We naturally put enormous faith in modern medicine because of its spectacular successes, but we can become severely disillusioned, frustrated, and even angry at the discrepancy between our expectations of what medicine can do and the reality. When you come right down to it, there are very few medical cures at present or on the horizon for the chronic diseases and other chronic conditions, such as many forms of pain, although they are a major cause of suffering, disability, and death in our society. It is far better to prevent them in the first place, if possible, than to have to be treated for them. Although a great deal is known about the molecular biology of certain cancers and there are effective treatments for some forms of cancer, many cancers are presently only very poorly understood and effective treatments do not exist. Yet even in such cases, there are always some people who survive much longer than expected. In some instances, tumors have been known to regress or disappear altogether, even without medical treatment. Medicine knows almost nothing about why this happens or how, yet it is known to happen. This in itself can be a source of some hope for people when they have exhausted the options available in traditional medicine. Most doctors acknowledge the role of the mind and social factors in healing. Often they refer to it as the will to live, yet no one understands it. If a person believes he or she is going to die and loses hope, this emotional capitulation itself can tilt the system against recovery. Personal motivations to live are known to sometimes influence survival. Emotional disposition and support from family and friends can make a big difference in how people do in the face of serious illness. Dr. George Engel, late professor emeritus at the University of Rochester Medical School, was a major voice articulating an expanded model for the practice of medicine, a model that takes into account the importance of psychological and social factors in health and disease, and that takes a systems perspective on health and illness and the patient as a whole person. Many of his students are now carrying on his legacy, and Rochester Medical School is currently a leader in mindfulness training of physicians and medical students. Dr. Engel's model is known as the biopsychosocial model. Until his model was put forth, the effects of psychological factors on physical illness was not addressed in a major way in the curriculum of modern medical education, although it had been recognized since the days of Hippocrates that the mind plays a major and sometimes primary role in disease and health. The virtual exclusion of the domain of the mind from the major currents in medical education was due mainly to the fact that since the time of Descartes in the 17th century, Western scientific thinking has divided the intrinsic wholeness of being into separate, essentially non-interacting domains of soma, that is body, and psyche, that is mind. While these are convenient categories for facilitating understanding on one level, the tendency has been to forget that mind and body are separate in thought only. This dualistic way of thinking and seeing has so permeated Western culture that it had closed off the entire realm of mind-body interactions in health as a legitimate domain of scientific inquiry. Only very recently has this begun to change, as the major weaknesses of this dualistic paradigm have become apparent. How do we consciously cultivate the stress response in daily life? The same way we cultivate mindfulness in the formal meditation practice, that is, moment by moment, grounding ourselves in our body and in our breathing. When your buttons are pushed, or you find yourself feeling stressed, when feelings of fight or flight come up, you might try bringing your awareness to your face and shoulders as they tense up, to your heart beginning to pound, to your stomach beginning to feel funny, to whatever you might notice about how your body feels at that moment. See if you can be aware of your feelings of anger or fear or hurt as you feel them rising inside of you. You might even try saying to yourself, "This is it," or "Here is a stressful situation," or "Now is a time to tune into my breathing and center myself." Mindfulness sets the stage for you to respond appropriately right here in the moment. If you are quick enough, you can sometimes catch the stress reaction before it develops completely and turn it into a response instead. It takes practice to catch stress reactions as they are happening, but don't worry, if you're like most of us, you will have plenty of opportunities to practice. The place to start, of course, is with your breathing. If you can manage to bring your attention to your breathing for even the briefest moment, it will set the stage for facing that moment and the next one mindfully. The breath reconnects you with calmness and awareness when you lose touch momentarily. It brings you to an awareness of your body in that moment, including any increase in muscle tension. It can also remind you to check your thoughts and feelings. Perhaps you will see how reactive they are. Perhaps you will question their accuracy. If the original cause of your stress has already passed, you will be more likely to see that at that moment, whatever has happened has already happened. It's already in the past. This perception frees you to put your energies into facing the present and dealing with whatever problems require your immediate attention. When you channel your energies in this way, you will experience a quicker recovery of your mental equilibrium, even in very stressful situations, and also of your physiological equilibrium, what we have been calling homeostasis, as your bodily reactions calm down. Having an alternative way of handling pressure can reduce our dependence on the common maladaptive coping strategies we so often resort to and get stuck in when we feel tense. As relaxation and peace of mind become more familiar to you through the formal meditation practice, it becomes easier to call upon them when you need them. When you are stressed, You can allow yourself to ride the waves of the stress. You will neither have to shut it off nor run away. True, you may be going up and down some emotionally, but much less than if you are always at the mercy of your own automatic reactivity. Greater resilience in the face of stressors and reduced stress reactivity are characteristic of people who practice meditation regularly. As we have seen, the fact that you can learn to respond to stress with awareness does not mean that you will never react anymore, or that you will not sometimes be overwhelmed by anger or grief or fear. We're not trying to suppress our emotions when we respond to stress. Rather, we are learning how to work with all our reactions, emotional and physical, so that we may be less controlled by them and see more clearly what we should do and how we might respond effectively. When you cultivate mindfulness in your life, your ability to be fully present can come through even under the most trying of circumstances. It will cradle and embrace the full catastrophe itself. Sometimes this will reduce your pain, and sometimes it may not. But awareness brings comfort of a certain kind even in the midst of suffering. We could call it the comfort of wisdom and inner trust, the comfort of being whole. All the potential stressors that we have examined so far, including time pressures, other people, and confining roles, converge in the work arena. They can be sorely compounded by our need to make money. Most of us have to do something to earn money to live, and most jobs are at least potentially stressful in a variety of ways. But work is also a way of connecting with the larger world, a way of doing something useful, of making some kind of contribution of labor and effort to something meaningful, which hopefully has its own rewards beyond those of a paycheck. The sense of contributing something, of creating, of helping others, of putting our knowledge and skills to work can help us to feel a part of something bigger, something worth working for. If we could see our own work in this way, it might make it more tolerable even under difficult circumstances. People who can't work at all because of illness or injury often feel they would give anything to be working. We often forget or take for granted that work can lend meaning and coherence to our lives. To cope effectively with work stress as an individual practically requires that you look at your situation with eyes of wholeness, no matter what the particulars of your job may be. It helps to keep things in perspective if you ask yourself from time to time, what is the job I am really doing, and how can I best do it under the circumstances I find myself in? Bringing the meditation practice to bear on your work life can make for major improvements in the quality of your life at work, no matter what your job. You do not always have to get out of a stressful job for your work life to start to change in positive ways. Sometimes simply deciding as an experiment to make your work part of your meditation practice, part of your work on yourself, can shift the balance from a sense of being done in by the job to a sense of knowing what you are doing and choosing to do it. This change in perspective can lead directly to a change in what your job means to you. Work can become a vehicle that you are purposefully using to learn and to grow. Obstacles then become challenges and opportunities. Frustrations, occasions to practice patience. What other people are doing or not doing, occasions to be assertive and communicate effectively. And power struggles, occasions to watch the play of greed, aversion, and unawareness in other people and in yourself. In all likelihood, if we saw work as an arena in which we could hone inner strength and wisdom moment by moment, we would make better decisions, communicate more effectively, be more efficient, and perhaps even leave work happier at the end of the day. Our lives are so complex and our minds so busy and agitated most of the time that it is necessary, especially at the beginning, to protect and support your meditation practice by making a special time for it, and, if possible, by making a special place in your home where you will feel particularly comfortable and at home while practicing. keeping to the path you have chosen when you run into obstacles and may not be seeing quote-unquote results right away is the real measure of your commitment. This is where conscious intentionality comes in. The intention to practice whether you feel like it or not on a particular day, whether it is convenient or not, with the determination of an athlete. Some people have resistance to the whole idea of taking time for themselves. The Puritan ethic has left a legacy of guilt when we do something for ourselves. If you do feel undeserving of taking time for yourself, why not look at that as part of your mindfulness practice? Where do such feelings come from? What are the thoughts behind them? Can you observe them with acceptance? Are they accurate? Happily, once people start practicing mindfulness, most quickly get over the idea that it is selfish and narcissistic to take time for themselves, as they see the difference that making some time just to be has on the quality of their lives and their self-esteem, as well as on their relationships. Practicing meditation and yoga in the early morning has a positive influence on the rest of the day for me. When I start off the day dwelling in stillness, being mindful, nourishing the domain of being and cultivating calmness and concentration, I seem to be more mindful and relaxed the rest of the day and better able to recognize stress and handle it effectively. When I tune into my body and work it gently to stretch my joints and feel my muscles, my body feels more alive and vibrant than on the days I don't do it. I also know what state my body is in that day and what I might want to watch out for, such as my low back or my neck if they are particularly stiff or painful that morning. We leave it to each individual to experiment with times to practice and to choose the best one for his or her schedule. Practicing late at night is not recommended in the beginning, however, because it is very hard to keep up the alert attention required when you are tired. Most people who come to the stress reduction clinic, no matter what their medical problem is, tell us that they are really coming to attain peace of mind. This is an understandable goal given their mental and physical pain. But to achieve peace of mind, people have to kindle a vision of what they really want for themselves and keep that vision alive in the face of inner and outer hardships, obstacles, and setbacks. For some, that vision might be one of vibrancy and health. For others, it might be one of relaxation or kindness or peacefulness or harmony or wisdom. Your vision should be what is most important to you, what you believe is most fundamental to your ability to be your best self, to be at peace with yourself, to be whole. With this background to help you understand the spirit and the attitudes that are most helpful to cultivate in your meditation practice, we are now ready to explore the practice itself. As you have probably gathered by now, bringing mindfulness to any activity transforms it into a kind of meditation. Mindfulness dramatically amplifies the probability that any activity in which you are engaged will result in an expansion of your perspective and of your understanding of who you are. Much of the practice is simply a remembering, a reminding yourself to be fully awake, not lost in waking sleep or enshrouded in the veils of your thinking mind. Intentional practice is crucial to this process because the automatic pilot mode takes over so quickly when we forget to remember. I like the words remember and remind because they imply connections that already exist but need to be acknowledged anew. To remember, then, can be thought of as reconnecting with membership, with the set to which what one already knows belongs. That which we have forgotten is still here somewhere within us. It is access to it that is temporarily veiled. What has been forgotten needs to renew its membership in consciousness. For instance, when we remember to pay attention, to be in the present, to be in our body, we are already awake right in that moment of remembering. The membership completes itself as we remember our wholeness. The same can be said for reminding ourselves. It connects us with what some people call big mind, with a mind of wholeness, a mind that sees the whole forest as well as individual trees. Since we are always whole anyway, it's not that we have to do anything. We just have to remind ourselves of it. I believe that a major reason why the people in the stress reduction clinic take so quickly to the meditation and find it healing is that the practice of mindfulness reminds them of what they already knew but somehow didn't know they knew or weren't able to make use of, namely that they are already whole. We remember wholeness so readily because we don't have far to look for it. It is always within us, usually as a vague feeling or memory left over from when we were children. But it is a deeply familiar memory, one you recognize immediately as soon as you feel it again, like coming home after being away a long time. When you are immersed in doing without being centered, it feels like being away from home. And when you reconnect with being, even for a few moments, you know it immediately. You feel like you are at home no matter where you are and what problems you face. Part of the feeling in such moments is that you are at home in your body, too. It is a little peculiar that the English language doesn't allow us to rebody ourselves. It seems on the face of it to be just as necessary and useful a concept as to remind ourselves. In one way or another, all the work we do in the stress reduction clinic involves rebodying. Bodies are subject to inevitable breakdown, but they do seem to break down sooner and to heal less rapidly and less completely if they are not cared for and listened to in some basic ways. For this reason, taking proper care of your body is of great importance in both the prevention of disease and in the work of healing from disease, illness, or injury. Step number one in caring for your body, whether you are sick or injured or healthy, is to practice being in it. Tuning into your breathing and to the sensations that you can feel in your body is one very practical way to work at being in your body. It helps you to stay in close touch with it and then to act on what you learn as you listen to its messages. The body scan is a very powerful form of rebodying, since you are regularly checking in with and listening to and relaxing every region of your body systematically. You can't help developing greater familiarity with and confidence in your body when you do this. There are many different ways to practice being in your body. All enhance growth and change and healing, especially if they're done with meditative awareness. One of the most powerful in terms of its ability to transform the body, and most wonderful in terms of how good it feels to do it, is Hatha Yoga. As we have seen, the discovery that the immune system can be influenced by psychological factors bolstered the biopsychosocial model by providing one plausible biological pathway for explaining such mind-body interactions. Another important element pointing toward the need to include a role for the mind in a more accurate model of health and disease was the placebo effect, a very well-known phenomenon for which the standard biomedical model has no plausible explanation. Numerous studies have shown that when people believe that they are taking a drug of a particular potency, they show significant clinical effects typical of the drug in question, even when they did not actually get the drug but only a sugar pill, known as a placebo. In the late 1960s and the 1970s, a great deal of research in the field of biofeedback and self-regulation showed that human beings could learn to control many physiological functions that had previously been considered involuntary, such as heart rate, skin temperature, skin conductance, blood pressure, and brain waves, when they were given feedback from a machine that told them how they were doing. Another influence pushing medicine toward a new paradigm, if only indirectly, stems from the revolution in the science of physics that started around the turn of the 20th century and is still continuing. The most rigorous of the physical sciences has had to come to terms with some fundamental discoveries that showed that, at the deepest and most fundamental level, the natural world is neither describable nor understandable in conventional terms. Our basic notions that things are what they are, that they are where they are, and that one set of conditions always causes the same thing to happen, had to be completely revised to understand the world of the very small and the very fast. For instance, it is now known that the subatomic particles, such as electrons, protons, and neutrons, that make up the atoms of which all substances, including our bodies, are composed, have properties that appear sometimes wave-like and sometimes particle-like. Furthermore, they cannot be said to have a particular energy at a particular time with complete certainty, and the connections between events on this level of physical reality are only describable by probability. Physicists had to drastically expand their view of reality in order to describe what they found inside the atom. They coined the term complementarity to convey the idea that one thing, say an electron, can have two totally different and seemingly contradictory sets of physical properties, i.e., appear either as a wave or as a particle, depending on what method you use to look at it. They were obliged to invoke a principle of uncertainty as a fundamental law of nature to explain that one can know either the position of a subatomic particle or its momentum, but not both at the same time. And they had to develop the idea of a quantum field, which posits that matter cannot be separated from the space surrounding it, that is, that particles are simply condensations of a continuous field that exists everywhere. In this world description, it may not be meaningful to ask what causes the appearance or disappearance of matter out of the void, although this is known to occur. These new descriptions of reality, of the internal structure of the very atoms that make up our own bodies and the world, are so far from our ordinary mode of thinking that they require a major shift in our thinking. This means that it is now more acceptable to posit, for instance, that while science and medicine have a particular description of health, this description may not be the only possible valid one. The relief of symptoms of various kinds is a multi-billion-dollar industry. The slightest sniffle, headache, or stomach ache sends people scurrying to the medicine cabinet or drugstore in search of the magic something to make it go away. With a prescription from a physician, you can obtain drugs to reduce anxiety, such as Valium and Xanax, and drugs to relieve pain, such as Percodan. Tranquilizers such as Valium and Xanax and drugs that decrease the secretions of stomach acid such as Tagamet and Zantac are among the most prescribed medications in the country. This practice of immediately going for a drug to relieve a symptom reflects a widespread attitude that symptoms are inconvenient, useless threats to our ability to live life the way we want to live it, and that they should be suppressed or eliminated whenever possible. The problem with this attitude is that what we call symptoms are often the body's way of telling us that something is out of balance. They are feedback about dysregulation. If we ignore these messages, or worse, suppress them, it may only lead to more severe symptoms and more serious problems later on. What is more, the person doing this is not learning how to listen to and trust his or her body. The way of mindfulness is to accept ourselves right now, as we are, symptoms or no symptoms, pain or no pain, fear or no fear. Instead of rejecting our experience as undesirable, we ask, what is this symptom saying? What is it telling me about my body and my mind right now? We allow ourselves for a moment at least to go right into the full-blown feeling of the symptom. This takes a certain amount of courage, especially if the symptom involves pain or a chronic illness or fear of death. But you can at least dip your toe in, so to speak, by trying it just a little, say for 10 seconds, just to move in a little closer for a clearer look. As we do this, we may also become aware of our feelings about the symptom as they emerge. If there is anger or rejection or fear or despair or resignation, we look at that as well, as dispassionately as possible. Why? For no other reason than that it is here now. It is already a part of our experience. To move to greater levels of health and well-being, we have to start from where we actually are today, in this moment, not from where we would like to be. So looking closely at our symptoms and our feelings about them, and coming to accept them as they are, is of utmost importance. In this light, symptoms of illness or distress, plus your feelings about them, can be viewed as messengers coming to tell you something important about your body or about your mind. When a patient in the stress reduction clinic tells me that he or she had a headache during the body scan or during a sitting meditation, my response might be, "All right, now tell me how you worked with it." What I am looking for is whether, if you became aware that you had a headache during the time you were meditating, you used the occasion as an opportunity to look into this experience you're calling a headache, which is often a problem for you in your life anyway, even when you aren't meditating. Did you observe it with wise attention? Did you bring mindfulness and acceptance to feeling the sensations? Did you watch your thoughts at that moment? Or did the mind jump automatically into rejection and judging, perhaps to thinking that somehow you were failing at meditation, or that you, quote, can't relax, or that meditation doesn't work, or that nothing can cure your headaches? You cannot live a healthy life in our complex society without paying at least some attention to what you put into your body. Most of us find it quite difficult to change our habits, and dietary habits are no exception. Eating is a highly emotionally charged social and cultural activity. Our relationship to food has been conditioned and reinforced over our entire lifetime. Eating holds many different meanings for us. We have emotional associations with particular types of food, with eating a certain amount of food, with eating in particular places and at particular times, and with particular people. These associations with food can be part of our sense of identity and well-being. They can make changing our diet even more difficult than making other kinds of lifestyle changes. Perhaps the best place to begin is not by trying to make any changes at all, but simply by paying close attention to exactly what you are eating and how it affects you. Try observing exactly what your food looks like and how it tastes as you're eating it. The next time you sit down to a meal, really look at what's on your plate. What is its texture? Look at the colors, the shapes of the food. How does it smell? How do you feel as you look at it? How does it taste? Is it pleasurable or unpleasant? How do you feel right after eating it? Is it what you wanted? Does it agree with you? Notice how you feel an hour or two after eating. How's your energy level? Did eating what you ate give you energy, or did it make you feel sluggish? How does your belly feel? What do you think now about what you ate then? When people in the stress reduction clinic start paying attention to their eating in this way, they report some interesting observations. Some discover that they eat particular foods more out of habit than from liking them or wanting to eat them. Others notice that eating certain foods upsets their bellies or results in fatigue later on, connections they never noticed before. Many report that they enjoy eating much more because they are aware of it in a new way. Many of the patients in the stress reduction clinic make major changes in their diets long before we go into the question of diet in detail, which doesn't happen until the end of the program. These changes come about simply by bringing mindfulness to their eating as part of their daily informal meditation practice. Almost none of our patients come to the clinic seeking to lose weight or to change their diets. Nevertheless, many start eating more slowly. They find that they are satisfied eating less and are more aware of their impulses to use food to satisfy psychological needs. Some people actually lose weight over the 8 weeks simply by paying attention in this way and without consciously trying to lose weight. Poets and scientists alike are aware that our organism pulsates with the rhythms of its ancestry. Rhythm and pulsation are intrinsic to all life, from the beating of bacterial cilia to the alternating cycles of photosynthesis and respiration in plants, to the circadian rhythms of our own body and its biochemistry. These rhythms of the living world are embedded within the larger rhythms of the planet itself. The ebb and flow of the tides, the carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen cycles of the biosphere, the cycles of night and day, the seasons. Our very bodies are joined with the planet in a continual rhythmic exchange as matter and energy flow back and forth between our bodies and what we call, quote, the environment. One way this exchange of matter and energy happens is through breathing. With each breath, we exchange carbon dioxide molecules from inside our bodies for oxygen molecules from the surrounding air. The breath plays an extremely important role in meditation and in healing. Breathing is an incredibly powerful ally and teacher in the work of meditation, although people who have no training in meditation think nothing of it and find it uninteresting. Our breathing also has the virtue of being a very convenient process to support ongoing awareness in our daily lives. As long as we are alive, it is always with us. We can't leave home without it. It's always here to be attended to, no matter what we are doing or feeling or experiencing, no matter where we are. Tuning into it brings us right into the here and now. It immediately anchors our awareness in the body, in a fundamental, rhythmic, flowing life process. The easiest and most effective way to begin practicing mindfulness as a formal meditative practice is to simply focus your attention on your breathing and see what happens as you attempt to keep it there, just as we did before, but for longer than 3 minutes. There are a number of different places in the body where the breath can be observed. Obviously, one is the nostrils. If you are watching your breathing from here, you will be focusing on the feeling of the breath as it flows past the nostrils. Another place to focus on is the chest as it expands and contracts. And another is the belly, which moves in and out with each breath if it's relaxed. No matter which location you choose, the idea is to be aware of the sensations that accompany your breathing at that particular place and to hold them in the forefront of your awareness from moment to moment. Doing this, we feel the air as it flows in and out past the nostrils. We feel the movement of the muscles associated with breathing. We feel the belly as it moves in and out. Paying attention to your breathing means just paying attention, nothing more. It doesn't mean that you should push or force your breathing to try to make it deeper or to change its pattern or rhythm. The chances are your breath has been moving in and out of your body very well for years without your having thought about it at all. There is no need to try to control it now just because you've decided to pay attention to it. In fact, trying to control it is counterproductive. The effort we make in being mindful of the breathing is simply to be aware of the feeling of each in-breath and each out-breath. If you like, you can also be aware of the feeling of the breath as the direction of flow reverses. Another common mistake that people make when they first hear the meditation instructions about breathing is to assume that we are telling them to think about their breathing. But this is absolutely incorrect. Focusing on the breath does not mean that you should think about your breathing. It means you should be aware of it and feel the sensations associated with it and attend to their changing qualities. In the stress reduction clinic, we generally focus on the feelings of the breath at the belly rather than at the nostrils or in the chest. This is partly because doing so tends to be particularly relaxing and calming in the early stages of practice. All professionals who make use of their breathing as part of their work, such as opera singers, wind instrument players, dancers, actors, and martial artists, know the value of breathing from the belly and centering their awareness in this region. They know from firsthand experience that they will have more breath and better control if the breath comes from the belly. Mindful Hatha Yoga is the third major formal meditation technique that we practice in the stress reduction clinic, along with the body scan and sitting meditation. It consists of gentle stretching and strengthening exercises done very slowly with moment-to-moment awareness of breathing and of the sensations that arise as you put your body into various configurations known as postures. Many people in the stress reduction clinic swear by the yoga practice and prefer it to the sitting and the body scan. They are drawn to the relaxation and increased musculoskeletal strength and flexibility that come from regular yoga practice. What is more, after enduring the stillness of the sitting and the body scan for several weeks, it allows them at last to move. We practice the yoga with the same attitude that we bring to the sitting meditation and to the body scan. We do it without striving and without forcing. We practice accepting our body as we find it, in the present, from one moment to the next. While stretching or lifting or balancing, we learn to work at our limits, maintaining